This fight on the wall was not Aramilla's first assault in recent weeks by far. In truth, the frequency was increasing, with 3 or 4 attacks coming some days now. She knew very well that Elaine had insufficient soldiers to hold 6 leagues of wall. Burn her! Elaine was all too aware that she could not even spare trained hands to fit hoardings to all those miles of wall and towers. Untrained hands would only bungle the work. All Aramilla needed was to get enough men across to seize a gate. Then she could bring the battle into the city, where Elaine would be badly outnumbered. The population might rise in her favor, no certain thing, yet that only meant adding to the slaughter. Apprentices and grooms and shopkeepers fighting trained armsmen and mercenaries. Whoever sat on the Lion Throne then, and very likely that would not be Elaine Trakand, it would be stained red with the blood of Camelin. So apart from holding the gates and leaving watchmen on the towers, she had pulled all of her soldiers back into the inner city, close to the royal palace, and stationed men with looking glasses in the tallest spires of the palace. Whenever a watchman signaled an attack forming, linked kinswomen made gateways to carry soldiers to the spot. They took no part in the fighting, of course. She would not have allowed them to use the power as a weapon, even had they been willing. So far it had worked, though often by a hair. Low Camelin, outside the walls, was a warren of houses, shops, inns, and warehouses that allowed men too close before they were seen. 3 times her soldiers had been forced to fight on the ground inside the wall and to retake at least 1 wall tower. Bloody work, that. She would have burned Low Camelin to the ground to deny Aramilla's people cover, except that the fire might easily spread inside the walls and spawn a conflagration, spring rains or no spring rains. As it was, every night saw arsons inside the city, and containing those was difficult enough. Besides, people lived in those houses despite the siege, and she did not want to be remembered as the one who had destroyed their homes and livelihoods. No, what nettled her was that she had not thought of using the kin that way earlier. If she had, she would not be saddled with sea folk still, not to mention a bargain that gave up a square mile of Andor. Light! A square mile! Her mother had never given up 1 inch of Andor. Burn her! This siege hardly gave her time to mourn her mother. Orlini, her old nursemaid. Ravine had murdered her mother, and likely Lini had died trying to protect her. White-haired and thin with age, Lini would not have backed down even for one of the Forsaken. But thinking of Lini made her hear the woman's reedy voice. You can't put honey back in the comb, child. What was done, and she had to live with it. That's it, then, Kasela said. They're making for the ladders. It was true. All along the wall, Elaine's soldiers were pushing forward, Aramilla's falling back, climbing through the crenels where their ladders were propped. Men still died on the rampart, but the fight was ending. Elaine surprised herself by digging her heels into Fireheart's flanks. No one was quick enough to catch her this time. Pursued by shouts, she galloped across the street and flung herself out of the saddle at the base of the nearest tower before the gelding was fully halted. Pushing open the heavy door, she gathered her divided skirts and raced up the Widdershins' spiraling stairs, past large niches where clusters of armored men stared in amazement as she darted by. These towers were made to be defended against attackers trying to make their way down and into the city. At last the stairs opened into a large room, where stairs on the other side spiraled upward in the opposite direction. 20 men in mismatched helmets and breastplates were taking their ease, tossing dice, sitting against the wall, talking and laughing, as if there were no dead men beyond the room's 2 iron-strapped doors. Whatever they were doing, they stopped to gape when she appeared.
My lady, I wouldn't do that, a rough voice said as she laid hands on the iron bar across one of the doors.
Ignoring the man, she turned the bar on its pivot pin and pushed the door open. A hand caught at her skirt, but she pulled free. None of Aramilla's men remained on the wall, none standing, at least. Dozens of men lay on the blood-streaked guard walk, some still, others groaning. Any number of those might belong to Aramilla, but the ringing of steel had vanished. Most of the mercenaries were tending the wounded, or just squatting on their heels to catch their breath.
"Shake them off and pull up the bloody ladders," Birgitta shouted.
Loosing an arrow into the mass of men trying to flee down the dirt-paved low Camelin street below the wall, she knocked another and fired again. "Make them build more if they want to come again!" Some of the mercenaries leaned through crenels to obey, but only a handful. "I knew I shouldn't have let you come along today," she went on, still loosing shafts as fast as she could knock and draw. Crossbow bolts from the tower tops struck down men below as well, but tile-roofed warehouses offered shelter here for any who could get inside. It took a moment for Elaine to realize that last comment had been directed at her, and her face heated. "And how would you have stopped me?" she demanded, drawing herself up. "Quiver empty," Birgitta lowered her bow and turned with a scowl. "By tying you up and having her sit on you," she said, nodding toward Avienda, who was striding out of the tower. The glow of Sidar surrounded her, yet her horn-hilted belt knife was in her fist. Kasela and the rest of the guardswomen spilled out behind her, swords in hand and faces grim. Seeing Elaine unharmed changed their expressions not a whit. Those bloody women were insufferable when it came to treating her like a blown glass vase that might break at the rap of a knuckle. They would be worse than ever after this, and she would have to suffer it. "I would have caught you," Avienda muttered, rubbing her hip, "except that fool horse tossed me off." That was highly unlikely with such a placid mare. Avienda had simply managed to fall off. Seeing the situation, she slipped her knife back into its sheath quickly, trying to pretend she had never had it out. The light of Sidar vanished, too. "I was quite safe," Elaine tried to remove the acerbic touch from her voice without much success. "Min said I will bear my babes, sister. Until they're born, no harm can come to me." Avienda nodded slowly, thoughtfully, but Birgitta growled, "I'd just as soon you didn't put her visions to the test. Take too many chances and you might prove her wrong." That was foolish. Min was never wrong. Surely not.
"That was Alden Mihir's company," a tall mercenary said in lilting, if rough, Mirandian accents as he removed his helmet to reveal a lean, sweaty face with gray-streaked mustaches waxed to spikes. Rhys Abalaman, as he called himself, had eyes like stones and a thin-lipped smile that always seemed a leer. He had been listening to their conversation, and he kept darting sideways glances at Elaine while he talked to Birgitta.
"I recognized him, I did. Good man, Mihir's. I fought alongside him more times than I can remember I have. He'd almost made it to that warehouse door when your arrow took him in the neck, Captain General. A shame, that."
Elaine frowned.
"He made his choice as you did, Captain. You may regret the death of a friend, but I hope you aren't regretting your choice."
Most of the mercenaries she had put out of the city, maybe all, had signed on with Aramilla. Her greatest fear at present was that the woman would succeed in bribing companies still inside the walls. None of the mercenary captains had reported anything, but Mistress Harfor said approaches had been made, including an approach to Abalaman. The Mirandian favored her with his leer and a formal bow, flourishing a cloak he was not wearing.
"Oh, I fought against him as often as with, my lady. I'd have killed him, or he'd have killed me, had we come face to face this fine day. More acquaintance than friend, you see. And I'd much rather take gold to defend a wall like this than to attack it."
"I notice some of your men have crossbows on their backs, Captain, but I didn't see any using them."
"Not the mercenary way," Birgitta said dryly.
Irritation floated in the bond, though whether with Abalaman or Elaine there was no way to know. The sensation vanished quickly. Birgitta had learned to master her emotions once they discovered how she and Elaine mirrored one another through the bond. Very likely she wished Elaine could do the same, but then so did Elaine.
Abalaman rested his helmet on his hip. "You see, my lady, the way of it is, if you press a man too hard when he's trying to get off the field, attempting to ride him down and the like, well, the next time it's you trying to get off the field, he might return the favour. After all, if a man's leaving the field, then he's out of the fight now, isn't he?"
"Until he comes back tomorrow," Elaine snapped. "The next time I want to see those crossbows put to work."
"As you say, my lady,"
Abalaman said stiffly, making an equally stiff bow.
If you'll pardon me, I must be seeing to my men."
He stalked off without waiting on her pardon, shouting to his men to stir their lazy stumps.
"How far can he be trusted?" Elaine asked softly.
"As far as any mercenary," Birgitta replied just as quietly.
"If someone offers him enough gold, it becomes a toss of the dice, and not even Matt Coffin could say how they'll land."
That was a very odd remark. She wished she knew how Matt was, and dear Tom, and poor little Alver. Every night she offered prayers that they had escaped the Seanchans safely. There was nothing she could do to help them, though. She had enough on her plate trying to help herself at the moment.
"Will he obey me about the crossbows?"
Birgitta shook her head, and Elaine sighed. It was bad to give orders that would not be obeyed. It put people in the habit of disobeying. Moving close, she spoke in a near whisper.
"You look tired, Birgitta."
This was nothing for anyone else's ears. Birgitta's face was tight, her eyes haggard. Anyone could see that, but the bond said she was bone-weary, as it had for days now. But then Elaine felt that same dragging tiredness, as though her limbs were made of lead. Their bond mirrored more than emotions.
"You don't have to lead every counterattack yourself."
"And who else is there?"
For a moment, weariness larded Birgitta's voice, too, and her shoulders actually slumped, but she straightened quickly and strengthened her tone. It was pure willpower. Elaine could feel it, stone hard in the bond, so hard she wanted to weep.
"My officers are inexperienced boys," Birgitta went on, "or else men who came out of retirement and should still be warming their bones in front of their grandchildren's fireplace. Except for the mercenary captains, anyway. And there isn't one I'd trust without someone looking over his shoulder. Which brings us back to, who else but me?"
Elaine opened her mouth to argue. Not about the mercenaries. Birgitta had explained about them, bitterly and at great length. At times, mercenaries would fight as hard as any guardsman. But other times they pulled back rather than take too many casualties. Fewer men meant less gold for their next hire unless they could be replaced with men as good. Battles that could have been won had been lost instead because mercenaries left the field to preserve their numbers. They disliked doing it if anybody except their own kind was watching, though. That spoiled their reputation and lowered their hire price. But there had to be someone else. She could not afford Birgitta falling over from exhaustion. Light. She wished Gareth Bryn were there. Egwene needed him, but so did she. She opened her mouth, and suddenly rumbling booms crashed from the city behind her. She turned, and her mouth stayed open, gaping in astonishment now. Where moments before there had been clear sky over the inner city, a huge mass of black clouds loomed like sheer-sided mountains, forked lightning slashing down through a gray wall of rain that seemed as solid as the city walls. The gilded domes of the royal palace that should have been glittering in the sun were invisible behind that wall. That torrent fell only over the inner city. Everywhere else the sky remained bright and cloudless. There was nothing natural in that. Amazement lasted only moments, though. That silver-blue lightning, three-tined, five-tined, was striking inside Camelin, causing damage and maybe deaths. How had those clouds come to be? She reached to embrace Sidar, to disperse them. The true source slipped away from her, and then again. It was like trying to grasp a bead buried in a pot of grease. Just when she thought she had it, it squirted away. It was like this far too often now.
"Avienda, will you deal with that, please?"
"Of course," Avienda replied, embracing Sidar easily. Elaine stifled a surge of jealousy. Her difficulty was Rand's bloody fault, not her sister's.
"And thank you. I need the practice."
That was untrue, an attempt to spare her feelings. Avienda began weaving air, fire, water, and earth in complex patterns, and doing so nearly as smoothly as she herself could have, if much more slowly. Her sister lacked her skill with weather, but then she had not had the advantage of seafolk teaching. The clouds did not simply vanish, of course. First the lightnings became single bolts, dwindled in number, then ceased. That was the hardest part. Calling lightning was twirling a feather between your fingers compared to stopping it. That was more like picking up a blacksmith's anvil in your hands. Then the clouds began to spread out, to thin and grow paler. That was slow, too. Doing too much too fast with weather could cause effects that rippled across the countryside for leagues, and you never knew what the effects might be. Raging storms and flash floods were as likely as balmy days and gentle breezes. By the time the clouds had spread far enough to reach the outer walls of Camelin, they were grey, and dropping a steady, soaking downpour that quickly slicked Elaine's curls to her scalp.
"Is that enough?"
Smiling, Avienda turned her face up to let the rain run down her cheeks. "I love to watch water falling from the sky."
Light, you would think she had had enough of rain.
It had rained nearly every bloody day since spring came. "It's time to be getting back to the palace, Elaine," Birgitta said, tucking her bowstring into her coat pocket. She had begun unstringing her bow as soon as the clouds began moving toward them. "Some of these men need a sister's attention, and my breakfast seems 2 days past." Elaine scowled. The bond carried a wariness that told her all she needed to know. They must return to the palace to get Elaine, in her delicate condition, out of the rain, as if she might melt. Abruptly, she became aware of the groans from the wounded, and her face grew hot. Those men did need a sister's attention. Even if she could hold on to Sayadar, the least of their injuries were beyond her modest abilities, and Avienda was no better at healing. "Yes, it is time," she said. If only she could get her emotions back under control. Birgitta would be pleased at that, too. Spots of color decorated her cheeks, too, echoes of Elaine's shame. They looked very odd with the frown she wore as she hurried Elaine into the tower. Fireheart and Magin and the other horses were all standing patiently where their reins had been dropped, as Elaine expected. Even Magin was well-trained. They had the Wall Street utterly to themselves until Elise and the other kin walked out of the narrower way. There was not a cart or wagon to be seen. Every door in sight was tightly shut, every window curtained, though there might well be no one behind any of them. Most people had had sense enough to leave as soon as they caught a glimmering that hundreds of men were about to start swinging swords in their vicinity. One curtain twitched. A woman's face showed for a moment, then vanished. Some others took ghoulish delight in watching. Talking quietly among themselves, the four kinswomen took their places where they had opened their gateway some hours earlier. They eyed the corpses in the street and shook their heads, but these were not the first dead men they had seen. Not one would have been allowed to test for accepted, yet they were calm, sure of themselves, as dignified as sisters despite the rain soaking their hair and dresses. Learning Egwene's plan for the kin to be associated with the tower and a place for Aes Sedai to retire had lessened their fears over their future, especially once they found out that their rule would remain in place, and the former Aes Sedai would have to follow it too. Not all believed. Over the last month, 7 of their number had run away without leaving so much as a note, yet most did, and took strength from belief. Having work to do had restored their pride. Elaine had not realized that had been dented until they stopped seeing themselves as refugees wholly dependent on her. They held themselves straighter now. Worry had vanished from their faces, and they were not so quick to bend their necks for a sister, unfortunately. Though that part of it really had begun earlier. They once had considered Aes Sedai superior to mortal flesh, but had learned to their dismay that the shawl did not make a woman more than she was without it. Elise eyed Elaine, compressing her lips for a moment and adjusting her brown skirts unnecessarily. She had argued against Elaine being allowed, to come here, and Birgitta had almost given way. Elise was a forceful woman. "Are you ready for us, Captain General?" she said. "We are," Elaine said, but Elise waited until Birgitta nodded before linking with the other three kinswomen. She ignored Elaine after that one glance. Really, Nynaeve should never have begun trying to put some backbone into them, as she had put it. When she could lay hands on Nynaeve again, she was going to have words with the woman. The familiar vertical slash appeared and seemed to rotate into a view of the main stable-yard in the palace, a hole in the air nearly 4 paces by 4. But the view through the opening of the tall arched doors of one of the white marble stables was a little off-center from what she expected. When she rode onto the rain-drenched flagstones of the stable yard, she saw why. There was another gateway, slightly smaller, open. If you tried to open a gateway where one already existed, yours was displaced just enough that the two did not touch, though the gap between was thinner than a razor's edge. From that other gateway, a twinned column of men seemed to be riding out of the stable yard's outer wall, curving away to exit the stable yard through the open, iron-strapped gates. Some wore burnished helmet and breastplate or plate and mail, but every man had on the white-collared red coat of the Queen's Guard. A tall, broad-shouldered man with two golden knots on the left shoulder of his red coat stood in the rain watching them, helmet balanced on his hip.
"That's a sight to soothe sore eyes," Birgitta murmured.
Small groups of kinswomen were scouring the countryside for anyone trying to come to Elaine's support, but it was a chancy business. Thus far, the kinswomen had brought word of dozens and dozens of groups trying to find a way into the city, yet they'd only managed to locate 5 bands, totaling fewer than 1,000. Word had spread of how many men Aramilla had around the city, and men supporting Trakand were skittish about being found, about who might do the finding. As soon as Elaine and the others appeared, red-clad grooms with the white line on their left shoulders came running. A scrawny, gap-toothed fellow with a fringe of white hair took Fireheart's bridle, while a lean, graying woman held Elaine's stirrup for her to dismount. Ignoring the downpour, she strode toward the tall man, splashing water with every step. His hair hung every which way over his face, clinging wetly, but she could see he was young, well short of his middle years.
"The light shine on you, Lieutenant," she said. "Your name? How many did you bring? And from where?"
Through that smaller opening, she could see a line of horsemen extending out of sight among tall trees. Whenever a pair rode through, another appeared at the far end of the column. She would not have believed that many of the guards remained anywhere.
"Charles Gibbon, my queen," he replied, sinking to one knee and pressing a gauntleted fist to the flagstones. "Captain Kindlin in Arangil gave me permission to try reaching Camelin. That was after we learned Lady Neon and the others had escaped."
Elaine laughed. "Stand, man, stand. I'm not queen yet."
Arangil? There had never been so many of the guards there.
"As you say, my lady," he said as he regained his feet and made a bow that was more proper for the daughter heir.
"Can we continue this inside?" Birgitta put in irritably. Gibbon took in her coat with its gold stripes on the cuffs and knots of rank and offered a salute that she returned with a quick arm across her chest. If he was surprised to see a woman as captain general, he was wise enough not to show it.
"I'm soaked to the skin, and so are you, Elaine."
Avienda was right behind her, shawl wrapped around her head, and not looking so pleased with rain now that her white blouse clung wetly and her dark skirts hung with water. The guardswomen were leading their horses toward one of the stables, except for the 8 who would remain with Elaine until their replacements arrived. Gibbon made no comment on them, either. A very wise man. Elaine allowed herself to be hustled as far as the simple colonnade that offered entrance to the palace itself. Even here the guardswomen surrounded her, 4 ahead and 4 behind, so she felt a prisoner. Once out of the rain, though, she balked. She wanted to know. She tried again to embrace Sidar. Removing the moisture from her clothes would be a simple matter with the power, but the source skittered away once more. Avienda did not know the weave, so they had to stand there dripping. The plain iron stand lamps along the wall were still unlit, and with the rain the space was dim. Gibbon raked his hair into a semblance of order with his fingers. Light! He was little short of beautiful. His greenish hazel eyes were tired, but his face seemed suited to smiling. He looked as if he had not smiled in too long.
"Captain Kindlin said I could try to find men who'd been discharged by Gabriel, my lady, and they started flocking in as soon as I put out the call. You'd be surprised how many tucked their uniforms into a chest against the day they might be wanted again. A good many carried off their armor, too, which they shouldn't have done, strictly speaking, but I'm glad they did. I feared I'd waited too long when I heard of the siege. I was considering trying to fight my way to one of the city gates when Mistress Zygaine and the others found me."
A puzzled look came over his face.
She became very upset when I called her Aes Sedai, but that has to be the one power that brought us here.
It was, and she isn't, Elaine said impatiently. How many, man?
4,762 of the guards, my lady. And I encountered a number of lords and ladies who were trying to reach Camelin with their armsmen. Be content. I made sure they were loyal to you before I let them join me. There are none from the great houses, but they bring the total near to 10,000, my lady.
He said that as if it were of no moment at all. There are 40 horses fit for riding in the stable. I have brought you 10,000 soldiers. Elaine laughed and clapped her hands in delight.
Wonderful, Captain Gaibon! Wonderful!
Aramilla still had her outnumbered, but not so badly as before.
Guardsman Lieutenant, my lady. I am a lieutenant.
From this moment you are Captain Gaibon.
And my second, Birgitta added, at least for the present. You've shown resourcefulness, you're old enough to have experience, and I need both.
Gaibon seemed overwhelmed, bowing and murmuring stammered thanks.
Well, a man of his age would normally expect to serve at least 10 or 15 more years before being considered for captain, much less second to the captain general, however temporary.
And now it's past time for us to be getting into dry clothes, Birgitta continued. Especially you, Elaine.
The warder bond carried an implacable firmness that suggested she might try dragging Elaine if she dallied.
Temper flared, hot and sharp, but Elaine fought it down. She had nearly doubled the number of her soldiers, and she would not let anything spoil this day. Besides, she wanted dry clothes, too.
Chapter 14. Wet Things. Inside, the gilded stand lamps were lit, since daylight never penetrated far into the palace, flames flickering on the lamps that lacked glass mantles. The lamps' mirrors provided a good light in the bustling corridor, though, and bustling it was, with liveried servants scurrying in every direction, or sweeping, or mopping. Serving men with the white line on the left breast of their red coats were up on tall ladders taking down the winter tapestries, mainly flowers and scenes of summer, and putting up the spring tapestries, many displaying the colorful foliage of fall. Always 2 seasons ahead, for the majority of the hangings was the custom, to provide a touch of relief from winter's cold or summer's heat, to remind while spring's new growth was on all the trees that the branches would grow bare and the snows come again, to remind when dead leaves were falling and the first snows, too, and days grew ever colder that there would be a spring. There were a few battles among them, showing days of particular glory for Andor, but Elaine did not enjoy looking at those as much as she had as a girl. Still, they had their place now as well, tokens of what battle actually was. The difference between how a child looked at things and a woman did. Glory was always bought with blood. Glory aside, necessary things were often paid for with battle and blood. There were too few servants to carry out such tasks in a timely manner, and a fair number were white-haired pensioners with bent backs who seldom moved quickly in any case. However slow they were, she was glad they had willingly come out of retirement to train those newly hired and take up the slack left by those who had fled while Gabriel reigned, or after Rand took Camelin. Else the palace would have taken on the aspect of a barn by this time, a dirty barn. At least all of the winter runners were up off the floors. She left a damp trail behind her on the red and white floor tiles, and with all the spring rains, wet runners would have been sprouting mildew before nightfall. Servants in red and white, hurrying about their duties, looked aghast as they bowed or curtsied, which did nothing for her temper. They did not appear upset to see Avienda or Birgitta drenched and dripping, or the guardswomen either. Burn her if everyone did not stop expecting her to be mollycoddled all the day long. Her scowl was such that the servants began making their courtesies quickly and scurrying on. Her temper was becoming the stuff of evening stories in front of the fireplace, though she tried not to unleash it on servants. On anyone, really, but more so with servants. They lacked the luxury of shouting back. She intended to go straight to her apartments and change, but intentions or no, she turned aside when she saw Rhianna Corley walking in a crossing corridor where the floor tiles were all red.
The servant's reactions had nothing to do with it. She was not being stubborn. She was wet, and she wanted dry clothing and a warm towel in the worst way. But seeing the kinswoman was a surprise, and the two women with Rihanna also caught her eye. Birgitta muttered a curse before following her, swishing her bowstave sideways through the air as though thinking of striking someone. The bond carried a blend of long-suffering and irritability, soon stifled. Avienda never left Elaine's side, though busily trying to wring water out of her shawl. Despite all the rain she had seen, all the rivers since crossing the spine of the world and the great cisterns beneath the city, Avienda winced at the waste, the water splashing uselessly on the floor. The 8 guardswomen, left behind by her sudden swerve, hurried to catch up, stolid and silent except for the stamp of their boots on the floor tiles. Give anyone a sword and boots, and they began stamping. One of the women with Rihanna was Cara Defane, who had been the wise woman or healer of a fishing village on Toman Head before the Shanshan collared her. Plump and merry-eyed in brown wool with embroidered blue and white flowers at her cuffs, Cara appeared little older than Elaine, though she was nearly 50. The other was named Jalari, a former Damani from Shanshan. Despite everything, the sight of her made Elaine's flesh feel cold. Whatever else could be said of her, the woman was Shanshan after all. Not even Jalari herself knew how old she was, though she appeared just into her middle years. Slight of build, with long, fiery red hair and eyes as green as Avienda's, she and Marilla, the other Shanshan-born Damani who remained in the palace, persisted in maintaining that they still were Damani, that they needed to be collared because of what they could do. Daily walks were one way the kin were trying to accustom them to freedom. Carefully supervised walks, of course. They were always closely watched, day and night. Either might try to free the Suldam otherwise. For that matter, Kara herself was not trusted alone with any of the Suldam, nor was Lamour, a young Tarabonner noble, collared when Chanchico fell. The notion would not come to them on its own, yet there was no saying what either would do if a Suldam ordered her to help the woman escape. The habit of obedience remained strong in Kara and Lamour both. Jalari's eyes widened at the sight of Elaine, and she immediately fell to her knees with a thud. She tried to fold herself into a bundle on the floor, but Kara caught her shoulders and gently urged her back to her feet. Elaine tried not to let her distaste show, and hoped that if it did, everyone would take it for the kneeling and crouching. Some of it was. How could anyone want to be collared? She heard Linny's voice again and shivered. You can't know another woman's reasons until you've worn her dress for a year. Burn her if she had any desire to do that. No need for all that, Kara said. This is what we do. She curtsied, not very gracefully. She had never seen a town larger than a few hundred people before the Shanshan took her. After a moment, the red-haired woman spread her own dark blue skirts more awkwardly still. She almost fell over, in fact, and blushed a bright crimson. Jalari, sorry, she almost whispered, folding her hands at her waist. Her eyes she kept meekly directed at the floor. Jalari will try to remember. Aye, Kara said. Remember what I told you? I call you Jalari, but you call yourself I or me. Try it, and look at me. You can do it. She sounded as though she were encouraging a child. The Shanshan woman wet her lips, giving Kara a sidelong look. "Aye," she said softly, and promptly began weeping, tears rolling down her cheeks faster than she could wipe them away with her fingers. Kara enveloped her in a hug and made soothing noises. She seemed about to cry, too. Avienda shifted uncomfortably. It was not the tears. Men or women, Aiel wept unashamed when they felt the need, but for them touching hands was a great display in public. "Why don't you two walk on alone for a while?" Rihanna told the pair with a comforting smile that deepened the fine lines at the corners of her blue eyes. Her voice was high and lovely, suitable for singing. "I'll catch you up, and we can eat together." They offered her curtsies too, Jalari still weeping, and turned away with Kara's arm around the smaller woman's shoulders. "If you care to, my lady," Rihanna said before they had gone two steps, "we could talk on the way to your apartments." The woman's face was calm, and her tone put no special freight on the words, yet Elaine's jaw tightened. She forced it to relax. There was no point in being stubborn, stupid. She was wet, and beginning to shiver, though the day could hardly be called cold. "An excellent suggestion," she said, gathering her sodden gray skirts. "Come." "We could walk a little faster," Birgitta muttered, not quite far enough under her breath. "We could run," Avienda said, without trying to keep her voice low at all. "We might get dry from the exertion." Elaine ignored them and glided at a suitable pace. In her mother it would have been called regal. She was not sure she managed that, but she was not about to run through the palace, or even hurry. The sight of her rushing would start a dozen rumors, if not 100, each one of some dire event worse than the one before. Too many rumors floated on every breath of air as it was. The worst was that the city was about to fall, that she planned to flee before it did. No, she would be seen to be utterly unruffled. Everyone had to believe her completely confident, even if that was a false facade. Anything else, and she might as well yield to Aramilla. Fear of defeat had lost as many battles as weakness had, and she could not afford to lose a single one. "I thought the Captain General had you out scouting, Rihanna." Birgitta had been using two of the kin for scouts, women who could not make a gateway large enough to admit a horse cart, but with circles of kinswomen available to make gateways, for trade as well as moving soldiers, she had co-opted the remaining six who could travel on their own. An encircling army was no impediment to them. Yet Rihanna's well-cut, fine blue wool, though unadorned save for a red enameled circle pin on the high neck, was decidedly unsuited for skulking about the countryside. "The Captain General believes her scouts need rest. Unlike herself," Rihanna added blandly, raising an eyebrow at Birgitta. The bond carried a brief flash of annoyance. Avienda laughed for some reason. Elaine still did not understand Aiel humor. "Tomorrow I go out again. It takes me back to the days long ago when I was a pack peddler with one mule." The kin all followed many crafts during their long lives, always changing location and craft before anyone took note of how slowly they aged. The oldest among them had mastered half a dozen crafts or more, shifting from one to another easily. "I decided to use my free day helping Jellari settle on a surname," Rihanna grimaced. "It's custom in Shanshan to strike a girl's name from her family's rolls when she's collared, and the poor woman feels she has no right to the name she was born with. Jellari was given with the collar, but she wants to keep that." "There are more reasons to hate the Shanshan than I can count," Elaine said heatedly. Then, belatedly, she caught up to the import of it all. Learning to curtsy. Choosing a surname. Burn her if pregnancy was making her slow-witted on top of everything else. "When did Jellari change her mind about the collar?" There was no reason to let everyone know she was being dense today. The other woman's expression did not alter a whit, but she hesitated just long enough to let Elaine know her deception had failed. "Just this morning, after you and the Captain General left, or you'd have been informed." Rihanna hurried on, so the point had no time to fester. "And there's other news as good. At least it's somewhat good. One of the Suldam, Marley Neuchin, you recall her, has admitted seeing the weaves." "Oh, that is good news," Elaine murmured. "Very good. 28 more to go, but they might be easier now that one of them is broken." She had watched an attempt to convince Marley that she could learn to channel, that she could already see weaves of the power. The plump Shanshan woman had been stubbornly defiant even after she began crying. "Somewhat good," I said, Rihanna sighed. "In Marley's opinion, she might as well have admitted she kills children. Now she insists that she must be collared. She begs for the Eidam. It makes my skin creep. I don't know what to do with her." "Send her back to the Shanshan as soon as we can," Elaine replied. Rihanna stopped dead in shock, her eyebrows climbing. Birgitta cleared her throat loudly. Impatience filled the bond before being stifled, and the kinswoman gave a start, then began walking again at a faster pace than before. But they'll make her a Damani. I can't condemn any woman to that. Elaine gave her warder a look that slid off like a dagger sliding off good armor. Birgitta's expression was bland. To the golden-haired woman, being a warder contained strong elements of older sister, and worse, sometimes mother. I can, she said emphatically, lengthening her own stride. Well, it would not hurt to get dry a little sooner rather than later. She helped hold enough others prisoner that she deserves a taste of it herself, Rihanna. But that's not why I mean to send her back. If any of the others wants to stay and learn and make up for what she's done, I certainly won't hand her to the Shanchen. But light's truth, I hope they all feel like Marley. They'll put an eye-dom on her, Rihanna, but they won't be able to keep secret who she was. Every one-time Suldam I can send the Shanchen to collar will be a mattock digging at their roots.
A harsh decision, Rihanna said sadly.
She plucked at her skirts in an agitated manner, smoothed them, then plucked at them again.
Perhaps you might consider thinking on it for a few days. Surely it isn't anything that has to be done immediately.
Elaine gritted her teeth. The woman had as much as implied that she had reached this decision in one of her swinging moods. But had she? It seemed reasonable and logical. They could not keep the Suldam imprisoned forever. Sending those who did not want to be free back to the Shanchen was a way to be rid of them and strike a blow at the Shanchen at the same time. It was more than hatred of any Shanchen. Of course it was. Burn her, but she bloody well hated being unsure whether her own decisions were sound. She could not afford to make unsound decisions. Still, there was no hurry. Better to send back a group, if possible, in any event. There was less chance of someone arranging an accident that way. She did not put that sort of thing past the Shanchen. I will think on it, Rihanna, but I doubt I'll change my mind. Rihanna sighed again, deeply. Eager for her promised return to the White Tower and Novice White, she had been heard to say she envied Christian and Zarya. She wanted very much to enter the Green Aja, but Elaine had her doubts. Rihanna was kind-hearted, soft-hearted, in fact, and Elaine had never met any Green who could be called soft. Even those who seemed frilly or frail on the surface were cold steel inside. Ahead of them, Van Deen glided from a crossing corridor, slender, white-haired, and graceful in dark grey wool with deep brown trim, and turned in the same direction they were going, apparently without noticing them. She was green and as hard as a hammerhead. Jame, her warder, walked beside her, head bent in close conversation, now and then raking a hand through his thinning grey hair. Gnarled and lean, his dark green coat hanging loose on him, he was old, but every scrap as hard as she, an old root that could dull axes. Kirstian and Zarya, both in plain novice white, followed meekly with their hands folded at their waists, the one pale as a Kyrianan, the other short and slim-hipped. For runaways who had succeeded in what so few did, remaining free of the White Tower for years, over 300 years in Kirstian's case, they had resettled into their places as novices with remarkable ease. But then the kin's rule was a blending of the rules that governed novices and those that accepted lived by. Perhaps, to them, the white woolen dresses and the loss of freedom to come and go as they chose were the only real change, though the kin regulated that last to some extent.
I'm very glad she has those two to occupy her, Rihanna murmured in tones of sympathy. Pained caring shone in her eyes. It's good that she mourns her sister, but I fear she'd be obsessed with Adelius's death without Christian and Zarya. She may be anyway. I believe that dress she's wearing belonged to Adelius. I've tried offering solace. I have experience helping people overcome grief. I've been a village wise woman as well as wearing the red belt in Ebudar many years ago, but she won't give me two words.
In fact, Van Deen wore only her dead sister's clothing now, and Adelius's flowery perfume as well. At times Elaine thought Van Deen was trying to become Adelius, to offer up herself in order to bring her sister back to life. But could you fault someone for being obsessed with finding who had murdered her sister? Not that more than a handful of people knew that was what she was doing. Everyone else believed as Rihanna did, that she was absorbed with teaching Christian and Zarya. That and beginning their punishment for running away. Van Deen was doing both, of course, and with a will, yet it was really just a cover for her true purpose. Elaine reached out without looking and found Avienda's hand waiting to take hers, a comforting grip. She squeezed back, unable to imagine the grief of losing Avienda. They shared a quick glance, and Avienda's eyes mirrored her own feelings. Had she really once thought Aiel faces impassive and unreadable? As you say, Rihanna, she has Christian and Zarya to occupy her. Rihanna was not among the handful who knew the truth. We all mourn in our own way. Van Deen will find solace along her own path. When she found Adelius's murderer, it was to be hoped. If that failed to at least begin assuaging the pain, well, that was to be faced when it must be. For now, she must allow Van Deen her head, especially since she had no doubt the Green would ignore any attempt to rein her in. That was more than irritating. It was infuriating. She had to watch Van Deen perhaps destroying herself, and worse, make use of it. Having no alternative made that no less unpalatable. As Van Deen and her companions turned aside down another hallway, Rena Harfour peered out of a side corridor right in front of Elaine, a stout, quiet woman with a graying bun atop her head and an air of regal dignity, her formal scarlet tabard with the white line of Andor as always looking freshly ironed. Elaine had never seen her with the hair out of place or looking even slightly the worse for a long day spent overseeing the workings of the palace, and more besides. Her round face appeared puzzled for some reason, but it took on a look of concern at the sight of Elaine. "Why, my lady, you're drenched," she said, sounding shocked as she made her curtsy. "You need to get out of those wet things right away." "Thank you, Mistress Harfour," Elaine said through her teeth. "I hadn't noticed." She regretted the outburst instantly. The first maid had been as faithful to her as to her mother. But what made matters worse was that Mistress Harfour took her flare up in stride, never so much as blinking. Elaine Trecan's moods were no longer anything to be surprised at. "I will walk with you, if I may, my lady," she said calmly, falling in at Elaine's side. A freckled young serving woman carrying a basket of folded bed linens began to offer her courtesies, only a hair more directed at Elaine than the first maid, but Rena made a quick gesture that sent the girl scurrying before she completed bending her knees. Perhaps it was just to keep her from overhearing. Rena did not stop talking. "Three of the mercenary captains are demanding to meet with you. I put them in the blue reception room and told the servants to keep watch so no small valuables accidentally fall into their pockets. Not that I had to, as it turned out. Kariana Sedai and Saritha Sedai appeared soon after and settled in to keep the captains company. Captain Melar is with them, too." Elaine frowned. Melar. She was trying to keep him too busy for mischief, yet he had a way of turning up where and when she least wanted him. For that matter, so did Kariana and Saritha. One of them had to be the Black Aja killer. Unless it was Merilila, and she was beyond reach, it seemed. Rena knew about that. Keeping her in the dark would have been criminal. She had eyes everywhere, and they might notice a vital clue. "What do the mercenaries want, Mistress Harfour?" "More money is my guess," Birgitta growled, and swung her unstrung bow like a club. "Most likely," Rena agreed, "but they refused to tell me." Her mouth tightened slightly. No more than that, yet it seemed these mercenaries had managed to offend her. If they were stupid enough not to see that she was more than a superior serving woman, then they were very dense indeed. "Has Dialen returned?" Elaine asked, and when the first maid said not, added, "Then I will see these mercenaries as soon as I've changed clothes. She might as well get them out of the way." Rounding a corner, she found herself face to face with two of the Windfinders and barely suppressed a sigh. The sea folk were the last people on earth she wanted to confront right then. Lean and dark and barefoot in red brocaded silk trousers and a blue brocaded silk blouse with a green sash tied in an elaborate knot, Chaneladin Saren White Shark was aptly named. Elaine had no idea what a white shark looked like. It might well have been a little thing. But Chanella's big eyes were hard enough to belong on a fierce predator, especially when she took in Avienda. There was bad blood there. A tattooed hand raised the gold piercework scent box hanging on a chain about Shanella's neck, and she inhaled the sharp, spicy scent deeply, as though covering some foul odor. Avienda laughed out loud, which made Shanella's full lips grow thin. Thinner, at least. Thin was beyond them. The other was Renila Den Kellen, once windfinder to the mistress of the ships, in blue linen trousers and a red blouse slashed with blue, tied in a much less intricate knot. Both women wore the long white mourning stoles for Nesta Den Reis, yet Renila must have felt Nesta's death most keenly. She was carrying a carved wooden writing box with a capped ink jar set in one corner and a sheet of paper with a few scrawled lines clipped to its top. Wings of white in her black hair hid the 6 gold earrings in her ears, much thinner rings than the 8 she had worn before learning of Nesta's fate, and the gold honor chain crossing her dark left cheek looked stark, supporting only the medallion that named her clan. After Seafolk custom, Nesta's death had meant starting over for Renila, with no more rank than a woman raised from apprentice on the day she herself had put off her honors. Her face still held dignity, though much subdued, now that she was acting as Shanella's secretary. "I'm on my way," Elaine began, but Shanella cut her off imperiously. "What news do you have of Talan and of Merilila? Are you even trying to find them?" Elaine took a deep breath. Shouting at Shanella never did any good. The woman was more than willing to shout back, and seldom willing to listen to reason. She would not engage in another screaming match. Servants slipping by to either side did not pause to offer bows or curtsies. They could sense the mood here, but they shot grim looks at the Seafolk women. That was pleasing, though it should not have been. However upsetting they were, the Windfinders were guests. In a way, they were. Bargain or no bargain. Shanella had complained more than once of slow-footed servants and tepid bathwater, and that was pleasing, too. Still, she would maintain her dignity and civility. "The news is the same as yesterday," she replied in tones of moderation. Well, she attempted tones of moderation. If traces of sharpness remained, the Windfinder would have to live with them. "The same as last week and the week before that. Inquiries have been made at every inn in Camelin. Your apprentice is not to be found. Merilila is not to be found. It seems they must have managed to leave the city." The gate guards had been warned to watch for a Seafolk woman with tattooed hands, but they would not have tried to stop an Aes Sedai leaving, or taking anyone with her that she wanted. For that matter, the mercenaries would let anyone at all pass who offered a few coins. "And now, if you will excuse me, I am on my way." "That is not good enough!" Shanella's voice was hot enough to singe leather. "You Aes Sedai stick together as tightly as oysters. Merilila kidnapped Talan, and I think you are hiding her. We will search for them, and I assure you when we find them, Merilila will be punished sharply before she is sent to the ships to fulfill her part of the bargain."
"You seem to be forgetting yourself,"
Birgitta said. Her voice was mild, her face calm, but the bond quivered with anger. She held her bowstave propped in front of her with both hands as if to keep them from making fists. "You'll withdraw your accusations, or you'll suffer for it." Perhaps she was not as self-controlled as she seemed. This was no way to go on with Windfinders. They were women of power among their own people and accustomed to wielding it. But Birgitta did not hesitate. "By the bargain Zaida made, you're under the Lady Elaine's authority. You're under my authority. Any searching you do will be when you aren't needed. And unless I misremember badly, you're supposed to be in Tyr right now to bring back wagon loads of grain and salt beef. I strongly suggest you travel there immediately, or you might learn a little about punishment yourself." Oh, that was entirely the wrong way with Windfinders. "No," Elaine said as hotly as Shanella, surprising herself. "Search, if you wish, Shanella, you and all of the Windfinders. Search Camelin from end to end, and when you can't find Talan or Merilila, you will apologize for calling me a liar." Well, the woman had. As good as, anyway. She felt a strong desire to slap Shanella. She wanted to light. Her anger and Birgitta's were feeding one another. Frantically, she tried to soothe her fury before it burst into open rage, but the only result was a sudden longing to weep that she had to fight just as wildly. Shanella drew herself up, scowling.
You would claim we had reneged on the bargain. We have labored like bilge girls this past month and more. You will not cast us off without meeting your side of the bargain. Renila, the Aes Sedai at the Silver Swan are to be told, mind, that they must produce Merilila and Talon or else pay what the White Tower owes themselves. They cannot pay all, but they can make a start.
Renila began unscrewing the silver cap of the ink jar.
Not a note, Shanella snapped. Go yourself and tell them, now!
Tightening the cap, Renila bowed almost parallel to the floor, quickly touching fingertips to her heart.
As you command, she murmured, her face a dark mask.
She did not delay in obeying, setting out at a trot the way she had come with the writing box tucked under her arm. Still fighting the desire to strike Shanella and weep at the same time, Elaine winced. This was not the first time the Sea Folk had gone to the Silver Swan, nor even the second or third, but always before they had gone asking, not demanding. There were 9 sisters resident at the inn at present. The number kept changing as sisters entered the city or left, and rumor said there were other Aes Sedai in the city too, and it worried her that none had appeared at the palace. She had stayed clear of the Swan. She knew how much Elida wanted to lay hands on her, but not who the sisters at the Swan supported, or whether they supported anyone. They had been close-mouthed as mussels with Saritha and Kariana, yet she had expected some of them to come to the palace if only to learn what was behind the Sea Folk's claim. Why were so many Aes Sedai in Camelin when Tar Valon itself was under siege? She herself was the first answer that came to mind, and that made her more determined to avoid any sister she did not personally know to be a supporter of Egwene. But that would not stop word of the bargain made for aid in using the Bowl of the Winds from spreading, and of the price the tower had been committed to pay for that help. Burn her, but that news would be a bloody wagon load of fireworks going off at once when it became general knowledge among Aes Sedai. Worse, 10 wagon loads. Watching Renila trot away, she fought to steady her emotions and tried to bring the tone back to something approaching civilities. She handles her change in circumstances very well, I think. Shanella gave a dismissive puff.
And well she should. Every windfinder knows she will rise and fall many times before her body is given back to the salt.
She twisted to gaze after the other Sea Folk woman, and a touch of malice entered her voice. She seemed to be speaking to herself.
She fell from a greater height than most, and she should not have been surprised to find her landing hard after so many fingers she trod on while she was...
Her mouth snapped shut, and she jerked her head around to glare at Elaine, at Birgitta, at Avienda and Rena, even at the guardswomen, daring them to comment. Elaine prudently kept her mouth closed, and the light be thanked, so did everyone else. For her part, she thought she almost had her temper smoothed, the desire to cry suppressed, and she did not want to say anything that might start Shanella shouting and undo all her work. For that matter, she could not think of anything to say after hearing that. She doubted it was part of Atha Anmier's custom to take revenge on someone you believed had misused their position above you. It was very human, though. The Windfinder stared her up and down, frowning.
You're wet, she said, as though just noticing. It is very bad to be wet for long in your condition. You should change your clothes right away.
Elaine threw back her head and screamed as loudly as she could, a howl of pure outrage and fury. She screamed until her lungs were empty, leaving her panting. In the silence that followed, everyone stared at her in amazement. Almost everyone. Avienda began laughing so hard she had to lean against a tapestry of mounted hunters confronting a leopard that had turned. She had one arm pressed across the middle as if her ribs hurt. The bond carried amusement, too. Amusement! Though Birgitta's face remained as smooth as his sister's.
I must travel to Tyr, Shanella said breathily after a moment, and as she turned away, without another word or any gesture toward a courtesy.
Rena and Rihanna offered curtsies, neither quite meeting Elaine's eye, and pled duties before hurrying off.
Elaine stared at Birgitta and Avienda in turn.
If one of you says a single word, she said warningly.
Birgitta put on such an expression of innocence that it was palpably false, and the bond carried such mirth that Elaine found herself fighting the urge to laugh. Avienda only laughed the harder. Gathering her skirts and such dignity as she could summon, Elaine set out for her apartments. If she walked faster than before, well, she did want to get out of these damp clothes. That was the only reason. The only reason.
Chapter 15. A Different Skill. To Elaine's fury, a quiet, simmering fury that clenched her jaw, she got lost on the way to the apartments. Those rooms had been hers since she left the nursery, yet twice she took a turn only to find that it did not lead where she expected. And a sweeping flight of marble-railed stairs took her in entirely the wrong direction. Burn her! Now being with child was fuzzing her wits completely. She could feel puzzlement and increasing concern through the bond as she retraced her way, climbed a different set of stairs. Some of the guardswomen murmured uneasily, not quite loudly enough for her to make out the words, until the bannerwoman in charge, a slim, cool-eyed Saldaean named Devora Zarbayan, silenced them with a sharp word. Even Avienda began looking at her doubtfully. Well, she was not about to have getting lost in the palace flung in her face.
"Not a word from anybody," she said grimly.
"Not one," she added when Birgitta opened her mouth anyway. The golden-haired woman snapped her jaws shut and gave a tug at her thick braid, almost the way Nynaeve did. She did not bother to keep disapproval from her face, and the bond still carried puzzlement and worry. Enough that Elaine began to feel worried herself. She struggled to fight that off before she found herself wringing her hands and apologizing. It was that strong.
"I think I'll try to find my rooms, if I can have just a few words," Birgitta said in a tight voice. "I want to get dry before I wear out my boots. We need to talk of this later. I fear there's nothing to be done, but..."
With a stiff nod, barely bending her neck, she stalked off, slashing her unstrung bow from side to side. Elaine almost called her back. She wanted to, but Birgitta had as much need of dry clothing as she. Besides, her mood had swung to grumpy and stubborn. She was not going to talk about losing her way in the very halls where she had grown up, not now or later. Nothing to be done? What did that mean? If Birgitta was suggesting that her wits were too befuddled to be set straight... Her jaw tightened all over again. At last, after yet another unexpected turn, she found the tall, lion-carved doors of her apartments and heaved a small sigh of relief. She had begun to think her memories of the palace really were completely jumbled. A pair of guardswomen, resplendent in broad-brimmed hats with white plumes and lace-edged sashes embroidered with the white lion slanting across their burnished breastplates and more pale lace at their cuffs and necks, stiffened on either side of the doors at her approach. She intended them to have red-lacquered breastplates to match their silk coats and breeches when she had time to spend on that sort of thing. If they were to be so pretty that any assailant would discount them until it was too late, she would make them positively gaudy. None of the guardswomen seemed to mind. In fact, they were eagerly looking forward to the lacquered breastplates. She had overheard some who were unaware she was near disparage the guardswomen, mostly women, but including Doylan Melar, their own commander. Yet she had full confidence in their ability to protect her. They were brave and determined, or they would not have been there. Eurith Azeri and others who had been merchants' guards, a rare trade for women, gave daily lessons in the sword, and one or another of the warders gave a second lesson every day, too. Saritha's Ned Yarman and Vandine's Jame were quite laudatory about how quickly they learned. James said it was because they did not think they already knew something of how to use a blade, which seemed silly. How could you believe you already knew something if you needed lessons in it? Despite the guards already there, Devora told off two of those who accompanied her, and they drew their swords and went inside while Elaine waited in the corridor with Avienda and the rest, tapping her foot impatiently. Everyone avoided looking at her. The search was not a slur on the women guarding the doors.
She supposed it was possible for someone to scale the side of the palace. There certainly was carving enough to provide handholds, yet she felt irritation at being made to wait on it. Only when they came out and reported to Devorah that there were no assassins waiting within, no Aes Sedai waiting to whisk Elaine back to Elida and the tower, were she and Avienda allowed to enter, with the guardswomen forming up on either side of the doors with the others. She was not sure they would have physically prevented her from entering sooner, but so far she had been unwilling to put it to the test. Being restrained by her own bodyguards would have been beyond insufferable, no matter that they were just doing their jobs. Better to avoid the possibility altogether. A small fire burned on the white marble hearth of the anteroom, but it seemed to give little warmth. The carpets had been taken up for spring, and the floor tiles felt cold beneath the soles of her shoes, stout as they were. Asanda, her maid, spread red-trimmed grey skirts with still surprising grace, though the slim, white-haired woman suffered from painful joints, which she denied and refused healing for. She would have refused any suggestion that she return to her retirement as vehemently. Elaine's golden lily was embroidered large on her breast and proudly worn. Two younger women flanked her a pace back in similar livery, but with smaller lilies, stocky, square-faced sisters named Stephanie and Neris. Shy-eyed, yet quite well-trained by Asanda, they made deep curtsies, settling nearly to the floor. Slow-moving and frail Asanda might be, but she never wasted time in idle chit-chat or stating the obvious. There were no exclamations over how wet Elaine and Avienda were, though doubtless the guardswomen had alerted her.
"We'll get you both warm and dry, my lady, and right into something suitable for meeting mercenaries. The red silk with fire-drops on the neck should impress them suitably. It's past time you ate, too. Don't bother telling me you have, my lady. Neris, go fetch meals from the kitchens for the Lady Elaine and the Lady Avienda."
Avienda gave a snort of laughter, yet she had long since ceased objecting to being called lady. And a good thing, since she would never stop Asanda. With servants there were things you commanded and things you simply had to tolerate. Neris grimaced and took a deep breath for some reason, but dropped another deep curtsy, this to Asanda, and one only slightly deeper to Elaine. She and her sister were every bit as much in awe of the elderly woman as they were of the daughter heir of Andor, before gathering her skirts and darting into the corridor. Elaine grimaced, too. The guardswomen had also told Asanda about the mercenaries, apparently, and that she had not eaten. She hated people talking about her behind her back, but how much of that was her shifting moods? She could not recall being upset before because a maid knew what dress to lay out in advance, or because someone knew she was hungry and sent for a meal without being asked. Servants talked among themselves, gossiped constantly in truth, that was a given, and passed along anything that might help their mistress be served better if they were good at their jobs. Asanda was very good at hers. Still, it rankled, and it rankled the worse for her knowing that it was irrational. She let Asanda lead her and Avienda into the dressing room, with Stephanie bringing up the rear. She was feeling very miserable by this time, damp and shivering, not to mention angry with Birgitta for stalking off, frightened by losing her way in the place she had grown up, and sullen over her bodyguards gossiping about her. In truth, she felt absolutely wretched. Soon enough, though, Asanda had her out of her wet things and wrapped in a large white towel that had been hanging on a warming rack in front of the wide marble fireplace at the end of the room. That had a soothing effect. This fire was not at all small, and the room seemed not far short of hot, a welcome heat that soaked into the flesh and banished shivers. Asanda toweled Elaine's hair dry while Stephanie performed the same office for Avienda, which chagrined Avienda still, though this was hardly the first time. She and Elaine frequently brushed one another's hair at night, yet accepting this simple service from a lady's maid put spots of color in Avienda's sun-dark cheeks. When Stephanie opened one of the wardrobes lining one wall, Avienda sighed deeply. She held one towel loosely draped around her. Another woman drying her hair might be embarrassing, but near nudity presented no difficulties. And a second, smaller, was wrapped around her hair.
"Do you think I should wear wetlander clothes, Elaine, since we are going to meet these mercenaries?" she asked in tones of great reluctance. Asanda smiled. She enjoyed dressing Avienda in silks.
Elaine hid a smile of her own. No easy task, since she wanted to laugh. Her sister pretended to disdain silks, but she seldom missed an opportunity to wear them. "If you can bear it, Avienda," she said gravely, adjusting her own robing towel carefully. Asanda saw her in her skin every day, and Sephany too, but it was nothing to let happen without reason. "For best effect, we should both overawe them. You won't mind too much, will you?" But Avienda was already at the wardrobe, her towel gaping carelessly as she fingered dresses. Several sets of Aiel garb hung in another of the wardrobes, but Tylin had given her chests of finely cut silks and woolens before they left Ebu Dar, enough to fill nearly a quarter of the carved cabinets. That brief burst of amusement left Elaine no longer feeling as if she had to argue over everything, so without demur she let Asanda get her into the red silk, with fire drops the size of a finger joint sewn in a band around the high neck. The garment would impress, for sure, with no need for other jewels, though in truth the great serpent ring on her right hand was jewel enough for anyone. The white-haired woman had a delicate touch, but Elaine still winced as she began doing up the rows of tiny buttons down her back, tightening the bodice across her tender bosom. Opinions varied on how long that would last, yet all agreed that she could expect more swelling. Oh, how she wished Rand were near enough to share the full effect of her bond with him. That would teach him to get her with child so carelessly. Of course, she could have drunk the heartleaf tea before lying with him. She pushed that thought away firmly. This was all Rand's fault, and that was that. Avienda chose blue, which she often did, with rows of tiny pearls edging the bodice. The silk was not so deeply cut as Ebu Dari fashions, yet still would display a little cleavage. Few dresses sewn in Ebu Dar failed to do that. As Sephany began fastening her buttons, Avienda fondled something she had retrieved from her belt pouch, a small dagger with a rough hilt of deer horn wrapped in gold wire. It was also a Turangrial, though Elaine had not been able to puzzle out what it did before pregnancy forced a halt to such studies. She had not known her sister was carrying the thing. Avienda's eyes were almost dreamy as she stared at it. "Why does that fascinate you so?" Elaine asked. This was not the first time she had seen the other woman absorbed in that knife. Avienda gave a start and blinked at the dagger in her hands. The iron blade, it looked like iron at least, and felt almost like iron, had never been sharpened so far as Elaine could tell, and was little longer than her palm, though wide in proportion. Even the point was too blunt for stabbing. "I thought to give it to you, but you never said anything about it, so I thought I might be wrong, and then we would believe you were safe, from some dangers at least, when you were not. So I decided to keep it. That way, if I am right, at least I could protect you, and if I am wrong, it does no harm." Elaine shook her towel-wrapped head in confusion. "Right about what? What are you talking about?" "This," Avienda said, holding up the dagger. "I think that if you have this in your possession, the shadow cannot see you. Not the eyeless or the shadow twisted, maybe not even leaf blighter. Except that I must be wrong if you did not see it." Sephany gasped, her hands going still, until Asanda murmured a soft admonition. Asanda had lived too long to be shaken by mere mention of the shadow, or much else for that matter. Elaine stared. She had tried teaching Avienda to make Turangrial, but her sister possessed not a scrap of facility there. Yet perhaps she had a different skill, maybe even one that could be called a talent. "Come with me," she said, and taking Avienda's arm, she almost pulled her out of the dressing room. Asanda followed with a torrent of protest, and Sephany attempting to continue buttoning up Avienda's dress on the fly.